It's Friday, February 12th. The prosecution rests and the defense is rested. We start here. If you haven't been convinced yet, you're not going to be convinced.
The insurrection was the most violent and dangerous episode so far.
House impeachment managers have wrapped their opening arguments. What's next for President Trump's defense? These aren't the only charges being filed.
There was even discussion of having guns stationed across the Potomac River that could be brought in by boat.
New details on the group that was allegedly ready to deploy their own army. And Chinese New Year would already be scaled down even if people weren't scared of being attacked on the street.
Most of them are incredibly violent, and they involve elderly Asian Americans.
COVID isn't the only thing that's spreading. What's behind the rise in racist attacks nationwide? From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. A House impeachment article is like a charge, like an indictment. Doesn't mean the defendant is guilty. That is for a trial to decide.
So it'll be in order, and we'll convene as a court of impeachment in the chapter.
And so yesterday, in the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump, House impeachment managers made their case that not only did President Trump do something wrong, but that he was guilty, demonstrably guilty, of something that disqualifies him from holding office.
They truly believed that the whole intrusion was at the president's orders. And we know that because they said so.
I thought I was following my president. I thought I was following what we were called to do. He asked us to fly there. He asked us to be there.
Many of them actually posed for pictures, bragging about it on social media, and they tagged Mr. Trump in tweets.
We're outnumbered. There's a million of us out there, and we are listening to Trump.
For Democrats, this was the moment to make their argument. There likely aren't any witnesses coming. So this was the chance. And yesterday, they rested their case.
He wrote on his website, quote, "Trump just needs to fire the bat signal," and quote, "then the pain comes."
And we are joined now by one of former President Trump's impeachment trial attorneys.
And if you had any doubt about whether this is like a traditional trial, well, at one point, while the trial was unfolding, one of the defendant's lawyers left the room to go on Fox News.
As I said from the start of this thing, this trial never should have happened.
And this is during the prosecution's opening argument. Meanwhile, when they did reach a recess, Trump's other lawyer was approached by reporters.
What's your reaction to all the tape and video and evidence of insurrectionists citing Trump, taking orders from Trump for doing what they did?
Did someone say that they heard directly from President Trump to do that?
Yeah, that's what they said. Didn't you see that in trial just this morning?
I don't believe that's what happened.
They're saying that Donald Trump told them to do what they did. Am I hallucinating?
And legal analysts would tell you, if these were normal lawyers and normal jurors, the prosecution is pretty much winning. They're connecting the dots better than the defense. This is not a normal trial, but it still has huge implications for the legacy of President Trump. And Democrats would say it will have a direct effect on whether we see more political violence in the future. ABC's chief Washington correspondent Jonathan Carl joins us this morning. John, I mean, if day one was about reminding everyone just how horrible January 6th was, it kind of seemed like day two here was about tying that directly to President Trump. Did they do it? Did they demonstrate it?
Well, they have presented a methodical case that that Donald Trump is the reason why that riot happened, that he provoked it, he incited it.
The insurrection was the most violent and dangerous episode so far in Donald Trump's continuing pattern and practice of inciting violence.
Get him out of here. Throw him out.
Not just with the speech that he gave on that day in the White House ellipse.
So if you see somebody getting ready to throw a tomato, knock the crap out of them, would you? Seriously.
But through a pattern of behavior.
I promise you, I will pay for the legal fees, I promise.
That went back for weeks and months, went back before the election.
On April 17th, 2020, he tweeted, quote, "Liberate Michigan." Not even 2 weeks later, on April 30th, his supporters marched on the Michigan State Capitol in Lansing. They stormed the building.
Look, the first threshold you have to deal with here is it impeachable? Is it a high crime and misdemeanor to incite a riot, to incite insurrection against the United States government, another branch of government. It seems to me that virtually everybody in that room, probably roughly 100 senators, would say yes to that.
And on that day, where did he direct the crowd's ire? He directed them here, to Congress. He quite literally, at one part of that speech, pointed at us.
So the next question is, did Donald Trump incite that riot?
There's no question that his rhetoric was reckless. I was disappointed, frankly. I watched the speech as it was happening. I was disappointed particularly.
Now, some of those senators may also agree that they reached that threshold. Then you have the question of whether or not you can convict somebody in an impeachment trial who is a former president.
I simply do not believe that the Constitution allows us to impeach a private citizen.
If there is an opportunity or they think that there is a case, it should go to the courts, not to Congress where we don't have a sitting president.
And my sense is that many of those Republican senators are going to rest on that third one.
But so I'm confused by that, John, because if this was a trial, right, you'd have like a pretrial motion where the defense would say, judge, you should throw out this case. The judge says no. The jury's not even allowed to listen to that. Like, that doesn't go into the jury's mind at all, right? Once they're told, hey, your job is to listen to this case, they're not asking about whether this law is just or anything. And yet these jurors, because I guess they're also kind of the judges in some way, they can really just say, you know, I barely paid attention the last 2 days because this whole thing is illegitimate. I've decided that. I have no opinion on whether he did it or not.
Well, you know, Brad, you probably noticed this is not your typical trial. So this is not a typical situation. And yes,
we've put that jurisdictional constitutional issue to bed. It is over.
This was a case that the House managers made, that Jamie Raskin made, which is the court of impeachment. The United States Senate has already settled the question about whether or not it is constitutional to have this trial. There was a vote. And the vote passed.
What about when you said don't pay attention to the constitutionality, that you already voted on it?
Yeah, I thought that was a bizarre argument.
But you know, you had 44 Republican senators.
They're trying to play both sides of the legal argument.
All signs are still believe what they believed when they voted that the trial was unconstitutional.
Okay, so then today we're expecting to hear from President Trump's team. What do we know what argument they're going to make and how they're going to make it?
Well, we are told, first of all, that it will be a short presentation. You know, they have up to 16 hours to respond to this really forceful and detailed case that was outlined by the House impeachment managers.
How many hours do you plan to use tomorrow, sir?
I don't know. We were talking earlier, maybe 3 to 4 hours, something like that.
But we heard from one of the president's lead attorneys that they will use a very short period of time, a fraction of the 16 hours. I'm sure they will make the case that this is unconstitutional again, even though, as we've discussed, that is really settled as far as the Senate is concerned.
Is your argument mostly going to be based on the First Amendment or the actual substance of what the former president said?
Are those the only two choices?
No, I mean, you tell me.
Can you stop at this camera?
And then they'll make the case that the president was merely exercising his First Amendment rights, that he didn't incite those people, that this... this riot was something that was planned well in advance of his speech that day.
I think it puts at risk every senator in that chamber and every politician who wishes to speak passionate political speech.
All signs are that they will make the case that a lot of the Democrats, including some that are in that room, have used some of the very language that the president used in the build-up to that riot, that language about a big fight and fight for what you believe in, and that you know that they are no more responsible for violence as a result of what they said than the president is for what he said.
This could end this weekend, essentially, right? Or like maybe Monday or something. Like, this is hurtling towards a conclusion. What are the conclusions that are being drawn in your mind as someone who's watched this play out?
This certainly could be over by Sunday, maybe even in a scenario over by Saturday. And I don't see any scenario where any significant number of Republicans change their mind. In fact, I expect all 44 of the Republicans that voted that this trial shouldn't even happen will follow that up with a vote of not guilty.
He spread his big lie more. The most dangerous lie, as I mentioned, that Americans' votes were being stolen and that the final act of theft would occur here in the Capitol.
But I think that this is actually a very significant thing that the House managers have done here. They have methodically outlined in vivid and excruciating detail what happened on January 6th.
When they, the police, still barricaded and being attacked with poles, he said in his video to the people attacking them, "We love you. You're very special."
They have outlined what the president did leading up to that riot, that insurrection, and they have detailed what he failed to do once it started.
My dear colleagues, is there any political leader in this room who believes that if he is ever allowed by the Senate to get back into the Oval Office, Donald Trump would stop inciting violence to get his way? Would you bet the lives of more police officers on that? Would you bet the safety of your family on that? Would you bet the future of your democracy on that?
And that is part of the historic record now. And I think it will be something that defines Donald Trump and defines the Trump presidency for history.
And all 100 senators on the record. And that's why they're going to have to justify their decision in those terms that you laid out, John. This idea of, did I find him not guilty because it's not a crime, because he didn't actually do it, or because I just didn't think this trial should have ever happened in the first place? Jonathan Carl, thanks, bud.
Thanks, Brad.
You can see Republicans grappling with some of these ideas on whether to vote to convict President Trump. But one thing the facts have really borne out beyond a shadow of a doubt is just how violent the attack on the Capitol was and how much worse it might have been. Yes, there were protesters who stayed on the Capitol lawn and chanted. Even some people who walked through the smashed open doors might have just been there to take in the scene. But throughout this mob, there were large numbers of people that went straight to violence. In fact, many allegedly arrived with the express intent to kidnap, injure, and kill, and several expressed that they were ready to do so on behalf of President Trump. Now, it's not just the impeachment managers saying this. Increasingly, this explicit picture is being painted by law enforcement. ABC's Chief Justice Correspondent Pierre Thomas is with us. Pierre, you've been reading new filings from the Justice Department, right? What are you seeing?
Brad, the prosecutors had already alleged that some of the mob showed up to the Capitol with baseball bats.
So they were trying to convince you as they hit you?
Yeah, they were waving the thin blue line flag while they were assaulting us.
Metal pipes. Some were using bear mace, a chemical to squirt in the eyes of law enforcement.
It looked like a medieval battle scene. You know, it was some of the most brutal combat, you know, I've ever encountered.
But now there's new evidence coming in that there apparently was discussion, at least, of having a squad, a special squad, who would be heavily armed with guns that would be brought in if the president of the United States, then President Donald Trump, gave a signal that there was a need for additional support, something like martial law, and that these people had been engaging in war games and were planning for urban warfare and riot control. And according to the charges that we've been reviewing, there was even discussion of having guns stationed across the Potomac River that could be brought in by boat if needed.
Wow. And so, Pierre, I think it's worth delineating between, like, there are people who are sitting at home on Facebook during this time. They're getting really upset. They say, I'm going to go support President Trump in Washington, D.C. But then there were groups like the Oath Keepers are specifically mentioned in these filings. Who are groups like the Oath Keepers, and what kind of tactics are they planning on using?
Why are you guys here? To defend part of America.
Well, the Justice Department has defined the Oath Keepers as a militia group which heavily recruits or tries to recruit former military, law enforcement, fire and rescue personnel.
Vowing to disobey, quote, unconstitutional orders from what they see as an increasingly tyrannical president and government. Many, including the police, are uncomfortable with the Oath Keepers and their mission.
And they've been accused of engaging in some of the organizing that went into the insurrection, and they've been accused of actually communicating with each other during the actual assault.
Video obtained by ABC News. It shows Trump's longtime associate Roger Stone near men in militia gear, two of them with Oath Keeper insignias. That video just hours before the deadly Capitol Hill riot. Stone has denied.
Brad, let me just read you from an affidavit. According to this affidavit, some of the planning took place in November when suspected Oath Keeper, a woman by the name of Jessica Watkins, discussed operational plans with a co-defendant, Thomas Caldwell, that included, quote, establishing a quick reaction force stationed near the Capitol to provide weapons and to await orders to enter D.C. under permission from Trump not a minute sooner, end quote.
Right. And keep in mind, I guess, that a lot of this, the FBI says, comes from people within the Oath Keepers themselves, that they got these witness statements. And these people said they were under the impression they were part of an armed force that would forcefully take control of the American government at the express direction of President Trump. That literally, it seemed, up through January 6th, they thought that is what was being asked of them from the president himself, Pierre Thomas, in Washington. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Next up on Start here, it's inconceivable until you see someone knock down a grandmother in the street. The shocking rise in assaults against Asian Americans after the break.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
If you haven't been following, today is the Lunar New Year, which is obviously a big deal in many Chinese communities. But this last year has not been a kind one for many Chinese American families. Because not only have Asian Americans been dealing with the same pandemic that has loomed over everything in this country, they've also been experiencing a growing number of attacks, particularly in the Bay Area of California. ABC's Kana Whitworth is on the West Coast reporting this out. Kana, what have you found?
Yeah, Brad. So I was up there. I went to Oakland and San Francisco as well. And what we're seeing here is a rise in disturbing attacks. Most of them are incredibly violent, and they involve elderly Asian Americans. There's video of a 71-year-old grandmother who was pushed to the ground, beaten, and just left in the street. That happened in Chinatown in Oakland.
And when I seen the assault happen, it was just like, it was kind of hard for me to even watch it.
I spoke with her granddaughter. She said, you know, that her grandmother was traumatized.
She did get like really bad bruises from her being really skinny and getting pushed down pretty hard.
There was another example, a 91-year-old man pushed to the ground. That also happened in Oakland's Chinatown.
Oakland police say the suspect in that case also attacked a 60-year-old man and a 55-year-old woman that same day.
And after that, we started hearing from Hollywood. I mean, this is getting the attention of Hollywood, law enforcement, and the White House alike here.
Asians across the board have been targeted by racial slurs, being attacked, being pushed around, being spat on.
Actor and producers Daniel Wu and Daniel Dae Kim spoke out. They initially offered a $25,000 reward for an arrest.
We wanted to obviously bring the criminal to justice, but we also wanted to raise awareness for this issue because it had been going on for a year, and yet people did not care or did not know. It was surprising to both of us.
Daniel Dae Kim, he said, the way we see it, this is not just one community against another. This is everyone versus racism. And that's the bigger issue here. That's the issue that needs to be tackled.
And I think that the people who commit these kinds of crimes are cowards. I think they won't go after someone like 6'1" Daniel Wu, who is a black belt in martial arts. They are going to target our elderly and our children.
Why? I mean, why everything? Why any of this? And why specifically the elderly? Because it's just so demoralizing to see these videos.
So I spoke with the president of the Oakland Chinatown Chamber of Commerce.
Do you feel that elderly Asian Americans are being targeted?
Yes, because, you know, we're elderly, they're frail, and they cannot fight back. So they're quite often being the target.
And so people are coming into Chinatown, both in Oakland and San Francisco, doing this, and then for the most part, getting away with it.
And when I told them, can you talk about your incident? You know, guess what they told me? Some of them, they said they don't want to talk about it. And they tried not to admit what happened. And I said, why? And then they said, well, they are afraid losing customers because they feel unsafe coming to my store.
Now, there has been one arrest made, but these attacks have been going on for quite some time now, and I want to point out that in response to what they call an alarming escalation in xenophobia and bigotry since the beginning of the pandemic, Brad, Stop AAPI Hate launched a tracking project because of this, and they say that they saw more than 2,800 firsthand accounts, including violence, harassment, discrimination, shunning, and bullying in 47 states and the District of Columbia during the pandemic.
The rhetoric, you know, talk about the Chinese virus, that may also have a contributing factor.
Today, the district attorney filed murder charges in yet another high-profile violent crime against Asians.
This video showing a man on the subway spray an Asian man with Febreze.
We're told two men tried to set this 89-year-old Asian grandmother on fire last month.
It's not safe for the Asian community, and I hope everyone spreads awareness worldwide, and not only for the Bay Area, but the Asian communities around the world.
But so, Kana, I guess I'm wondering, what do you do? Like, how do you prevent this? Because we saw one guy allegedly responsible for three of these attacks. He comes out of nowhere. He bowls people over. So I guess I'm trying to figure out, are there ideas to actually stop this?
First of all, they've hired private security. Police have also promised a greater presence in these areas.
We're sending a message to those that commit crime in this city that we will pursue you and we will arrest you. It is not acceptable for things like this to happen in our community.
And youth groups in the area, they are volunteering to escort the senior citizens around and make sure that they're safe, or do things like go get their groceries for them.
Now, this Friday is Chinese New Year, and we will all be vigilant in protecting the Asian community.
It's such a sad thing because this time of year should be a happy time to be with family, be with friends. It's a warm time of the year. But now, you know, the members of our community are in fear. If you go to Chinatown, the streets are relatively quiet because people know to stay away from there.
I mean, this is already the first time in 150 years that San Francisco has had to cancel their New Year parade. And they did that among COVID concerns. And that's a huge blow to the community. I mean, this is the largest New Year parade outside of Asia. So this is a time, again, to celebrate. I know they will find ways to celebrate and they want to be able to do it safely.
All right, and today officials will have their eyes open across the country, as you said, at some of these Lunar New Year events. However, advocates have said you need a constant drumbeat of attention, a constant stream of prominent people telling Americans this is not okay, this type of hatred in the streets. Kana Whitworth in California. Thank you.
Hey, thanks, Brad.
Throughout this month, we are dedicating several segments to Black history. Not just history, even, but rather how history has informed where we are now. This week, we are handing the mic over to Sunny Hostin. You've probably seen her on ABC's The View. She's also a former prosecutor, and she said the events of this week compelled her to write this opinion piece, this audio essay, on a central question we are facing in the nation's capital. Here's Sunny now.
And one last thing. This week, when so many of us were watching the impeachment trial with renewed shock and horror, one moment in particular stood out to me.
He said, quote, "I'm a Black officer. There was a lot of racism that day."
The story of Black Capitol police officers breaking down in tears after surviving a mob that was calling them racial slurs to their faces.
You guys, you can't even call yourself American.
You're a traitor to your country. Yeah, you're a traitor.
According to reports, one officer began screaming so that everyone in the rotunda, including his white colleagues, could hear what he had just gone through. "These are racist ass terrorists," he yelled.
I sat down with one of my buddies, another Black guy, and tears just started streaming down my face. And I said, "What the F, man? Is this America?
Is this America?" And as I watched the bravery of U.S. Capitol Police Officer Eugene Goodman, who grew up in Southeast Washington, D.C., a ground combat vet who served in the Army, who faced down a mostly white mob, some carrying weapons, a Confederate flag, who ran past Senator Mitt Romney to face that mob.
Senator Mitt Romney almost comes face to face with insurrectionists, unknowingly walking straight towards them, until Officer Eugene Goodman steps in, directing Romney back to safety.
I thought, yes, this is America. The America that I live in. The America my Black father lives in. The America my Black husband lives in. The America my Black children were born into and live in. The truth of the matter is that American policing is rooted in racism. Its origins can be found in slave patrols, made up of white Southern volunteers empowered by the state to enforce slavery laws, empowered to locate and to return enslaved people, to punish them, to keep them in their place. The first slave patrols arose in South Carolina in the early 1700s.
Policing itself started out as slave patrols. We know that. And so what we've got to do is stop trying to put a Band-Aid on this problem and attack the institution that is perpetuating this culture.
And that history reflects the baked-in intersection of race, law, and policing.
Gene Goodman, Capitol Police officer, under assault 2 weeks ago, now escorting the vice president-elect.
This is the America that Officer Goodman clearly loves, has fought for, and continues to protect. He joined the ranks of police officers. But as I hear the deafening silence of the Blue Lives Matter crowd, I ask, does America love him back? Why is he not exalted as their patron saint? And I watch him as he stands guard, still, during the impeachment trial, in the back of the room, wearing a black mask with a blue line over it. So to see senators sitting at the very scene of the crime, now not even looking at the videos of the insurrection, those who claim that the trial is already over, the votes already cast, I ask myself, race, law, policing, are we at a crossroads or an intersection?
And our thanks to Sunny Hostin for giving us her take. We will have more contributors, more of these essays as the month goes on. Start Here is produced by David Rind, Kelly Therese, Josh Cohan, Lewis Millman, Ariel Chester, Tara Gimbel, and Lauren Efron. Thanks to Liz Alessi, Eric Johnson, Lakia Brown, John Newman, Elizabeth Russo, Abe Velez, and Stacia DeShishku. Special thanks this week to Sohel Udin, Kirat Radia, Carlos Betcher, Leighton Schneider, Chris Howell, Jonah Haskell, Stephanie Pawlowski, and Ben Siegel. I'm Brad Milkey. See you Monday.